Viewers from all around the world, a very warm welcome to this latest podcast episode being hosted by the Institute of South Asian Studies in the National University of Singapore. Welcome to all of you, and a good evening, a good afternoon, and a good morning, depending upon which part of the world you are located in at the time of listening to this podcast. Today, we are delighted to have with us an extremely distinguished guest, a very well-known name and expert in the field of international trade, and more specifically, with respect to trade policy issues connected to the South Asian region of the world. We have with us Professor Sanjay Kathuria. Professor Sanjay Kathuria is a very well-known name and does not specifically need an introduction for those who are familiar with regional trade issues and particularly those connected to South Asia. But nonetheless, for the benefit of those who might not have had the opportunity of knowing Professor Kathuria's background at length, I'll briefly introduce him and will have great pleasure in doing so. Professor Kathuria began his career at the Indian Council for Research on International Economic Relations, a leading economic policy think tank in Delhi, India. Thereafter, from there, he moved to the World Bank in the Washington, D.C., where he spent almost three decades in working at the World Bank. And he retired from the World Bank just a few months ago. And at the time of his retirement, he was the lead economist and coordinator for regional integration of the South Asian region at the World Bank. It is also very important to note that when one looks at the South Asian region, as Professor Kathuria has done specifically for several years during his life, it is important to have the regional experience, which somebody like Professor Kathuria has picked up over the time that he spent at the World Bank. And he was located at Bangladesh for 3 years during his tenure. Today, Professor Kathuria is busy in a large number of extremely productive intellectual preoccupations, including the teaching that he is engaged in with the Georgetown University, as well as the research that he's pursuing with the Center for Policy Research at Delhi in India. And we are extremely delighted to have with him here in this podcast today, where we are going to discuss some specific aspects of not just the trade scenario for the South Asian region of the world, but also probably reflect on the economic prospects of South Asia in the background of the ravages that have been inflicted by COVID-19, and also how the region is expected to recover in the months and years that we look ahead now. Sanjay, delighted to host you on this show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amitendu. I'm honored to be on this podcast with you and the Institute of South Asian Studies, and I very much look forward to our conversation.
Thank you so much, Sanjay. Let me begin with alluding to a couple of reports that have come out in recent months, influential reports, first by the Asian Development Bank, which is alluding to the fact that developing Asia is experiencing its first economic recession in more than six decades. And of course, this is a fairly broad-based recession, but among various parts of the Asian region, South Asia is notably projected to experience the greatest volume of contraction in economic growth. And this is a view which subsequently has been supported by similar projections, but global projections that have come out from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, respectively. So I wanted to have your informed opinion on what is your sense of the difficulties that South Asia is experiencing in terms of this very serious growth contraction, and when do you expect the region to recover?
Yeah, thank you very much, Amitendu. So yes, all these global institutions have made these dire predictions in line with reality. In fact, as you noted, for 2020, the World Bank is forecasting a decline of almost 8%, 7.7% in GDP, and the IMF is going even a little bit more than that. Of course, it's so the difficulties are huge, and you know, in South Asia, obviously, because of the massive informal sectors that prevail, like in sub-Saharan Africa, the problems become even more difficult to tackle. Because how do you reach workers who are not in any way connected with a formal system? And we've seen that, especially that the plight of, say, migrant workers in India, you know, as more than 100 million migrant workers, as they left or they tried to leave after the lockdown, after they were allowed to go back, and even in between, you know, going on foot, the plight of migrants going on foot from the cities back to the villages. So the issue of protecting lives, you know, from, and then at the same time protecting livelihoods, this is a twin challenge of South Asia, which is almost, you know, it's a very, very difficult task to tackle. And I think this is reflected in the fact that South Asia is projected to be such, you know, a region which is hit so hard in all these forecasts. And, you know, for example, if you look at, you know, services sector again, which dominates, which is strong, which is high, the share of GDP in services is high in many of the countries in the region. This has been taken a huge hit, and especially in the contact intensive sectors. Now, for example, the purchase managers index in India, if you think about it, it was down to an almost a crazily low figure of 5.4 in April of this year. You know, we know that 50 is the halfway point. Beyond 50 is when they expect a sector, those who are interviewed expect a sector to expand. And below 50 is when they expect it to contract. So you can just imagine 5.4 is like, you know, bottom of the heap. It's never happened since this index was compiled in India. Now in September, I understand it's creeping back almost close to 50 in India. It's 49.6 or 49.8. So I think, so there's that aspect of the informal workers and how do you reach them, right? Getting the social safety net, the jobs, or you know, the informal jobs, the social safety net kind of jobs, like you have the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme in India. Now, so therefore, and then the other issues is that South Asia, rest of the developing world, really lacks fiscal firepower, right? Because we know they don't have convertible currencies. So you are always worried, looking over your shoulder as a policymaker about your, you know, your debt ratings, your, you know, sovereign ratings, or your ability to borrow in the market, because the market is not particularly, it's much harder on countries which don't have convertible currencies. And therefore this affects not only recovery, but also the sustainability. If you have taken on some debt, which all the countries are being forced to take on additional debt during the crisis. And then there's this issue, the danger of what has been called a K-shaped recovery, right? So where the inequality that was there prior to COVID becomes exacerbated because of, you know, the haves and the have-nots, the divide, because of the digital divide, the divide, you know, the younger people losing jobs, women losing jobs disproportionately. So while those who are in the digital economy are gaining, actually, those the rest are actually losing. So there is this very stark danger of a K-shaped recovery, which is, you know, which is more problematic for South Asia because of its, you know, very large informality, and also, you know, the poverty rates are still very high. So therefore, when it comes back to, when we're talking of any, let's say, recovery, it's obviously very hard because there's so many degrees of uncertainty. But if you do a very quick back of the envelope, and let's say use the World Bank projections, so you had -7.7 in the current year, I mean calendar year, this year, and then there is 4.5 in 2021 and 4.6 in 2022. If you put all of these together, it means by the end of 2022, we will be flat. We will just have recovered just about GDP that we were in 2019. So for 3 years, we've been running on a treadmill, so to speak, on a flat treadmill. So this is a devastating state of affairs. And obviously, things could get worse. Hopefully, they will get better than these predictions. Sure.
Sajay, that actually, I think, is a fairly, I would say, comprehensive, enlightening, but also somewhat dismal sense that we get out of the conditions that are surrounding the region at this point in time. But to be absolutely realistic, I think the points that you touch upon are very significant, and probably they point to the fact that South Asia as a region will find it in some respects tougher than many other regions of the world in coming back to what you described as the flat, because it has much more vulnerabilities. It has much more peculiarities in the economic structures, like informality, for example, which will probably make its return to the normal or the baseline scenario that much more difficult. But on the back of that view, if we now take a closer look at the regional trade prospects, I think one of the things that we do understand is that any kind of recovery for the South Asian region will need to have a contribution from the role that it plays in the regional and global growth. And there are countries that we will probably discuss a little bit more specifically in our conversation as we go ahead. But as a whole for the region, what is your expectation of the regional trade outlook, let's say, over the next one or more than 1 year?
Yeah, so thank you, Amitendu. To answer that question, I will highlight three factors. So one is obviously the overall world trade growth, since South Asia is part of world trade, and overall world trade growth. And there the, you know, as you would know, the decline forecast by the WTO is somewhat better in the last couple of weeks than it was a few months ago. So now the forecast is for a 9.2% decline in world trade in 2020, in volume terms, merchandise trade, better than 13%, the decline of 13% expected earlier. And then the recovery expected is 7.2% in 2021. And the IMF numbers for both goods and services are somewhat similar. Now, so 2020 was better a little bit because there was, COVID-related products trade, you know, expanded fast. There was some replenishment of inventories. But at the same time, the forecast for 2021 is more pessimistic than earlier. And if, again, using the same methodology, if you look at overall world trade in 2021, it will be much below the pre-COVID trend. And of course, and this forecast itself, I think the WTO points out, is downside risks are quite high in this forecast. So this is the first factor. And I guess one can almost take world trade, say, okay, this is what it is. It's a given for South Asia, and it will continue to be turbulent. So what can South Asia, what is the outlook for South Asia in the context of a depressed world trade scenario? So then my second point relates to trade within South Asia, which I submit has become even more important now than it was before COVID. And several points in support of this argument I would make. One is that South Asia was always under trading with itself. And we've made this point, me and my colleagues in the World Bank, in our recent report, A Glass Half Full. We've shown that goods trade is only a 1/3 of its potential. So that's the first point. Then South Asia will hopefully return soon to becoming one of the fastest growing regions in the world, if not the fastest. And this can provide impetus to intra-regional trade and therefore steadiness to overall trade. And in other words, the region can become an anchor for itself. And the former World Bank chief economist, Penny Goldberg, had made a similar point in a piece in Project Syndicate on the fact, relating to the fact that regional trade can become more important for countries in the wake of increasing uncertainty in global trade and not likely to go back to pre-global financial crisis trends. And finally, in this point, with the onset of COVID-19, I believe that regional value chains are likely to become even more important within South Asia and South Asia-East Asia connections. And I can come back to this theme. So this is the second overall theme of the regional trade aspect, how well South Asia is able to take advantage of these trends and opportunities will be key to its overall trade outlook. And the third aspect on your question is that the world is looking to diversify, as you know, its sources of supply and not relying merely on one or two countries. And South Asia, which is underrepresented in world trade and global value chains, can take advantage. So to summarize, world trade will be volatile. Overall trends will be unlikely go pre-2008 way. You know, the trends will be much lower. However, South Asia now has fresh opportunities, both in regional and global trade, and to increase its share in world trade. And the question then is, can it take advantage of it?
That's wonderful, Sanjay. In fact, I'm glad that you alluded to supply chains, the regional supply chains, a point that we will talk about a little bit more in the rest of the conversation that we have. But before that, I also wanted to reflect on the other point that you mentioned, the importance of the South Asian region expanding the intra-regional trade, the trade that goes on within itself. And you really have been looking at this subject at length over the work that you have done in the years that you have put into the regional trade issues. And one of the factors that you have been alluding to, one of the factors that we know is extremely important for South Asia to get going on in order to accelerate intra-regional trade is bringing down the trade costs within the region, particularly so far as movement of goods between countries across borders is concerned. One good thing is that we are noticing some encouraging developments here. Let's say, for example, between two of the largest economies of the region, India and Bangladesh, there have been some examples of cross-border land connectivity improving in recent time. Also, the inland waterways agreement have been being executed. So do you think that these are examples which can be shared across the greater South Asian region, but at a time when the COVID is active, of course, there will be difficulties, but might this be a model that is achieving the little bit of basics as far as possible? Might that be the model for the region to go forward?
Right, absolutely. So I think this is, as you noted, this is a very important question. And we know that intra-regional trade in South Asia is most expensive to conduct compared to any other region, and is one a critical reason why trade within the region is so low. And I do agree that connectivity initiatives across the region do hold a lot of promise. And quite a lot is happening there, some of it not with so much of fanfare, some with some fanfare. So let me try to connect these dots. As you know, there are quite a lot of bilateral initiatives going on in trade. And in trade, I would include also energy trade because it's a part of trade and services. So for example, India, Bangladesh, there are things going on in connectivity. You know, India has access to the Chittagong port to access its own northeast region. And so that's a very important development. So to reduce the isolation of the northeast and, you know, become, have it become part of mainstream India, and also you, and then connect with the rest of the Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Nepal sub-region, the so-called BBIN. So there is initiatives on connectivity between India and Bangladesh, and a lot more. There have been trial runs. There is passenger vehicle initiatives. There are train initiatives connecting, you know, borders, Silchar with Dhaka, and so on. So there's a lot going on there on the connectivity side. And on the energy side, India is exporting a growing amount of power and also investing in Bangladesh in energy trade. So there's a lot of promise in this. Similarly, India-Bhutan, there is energy trade and transit, energy trade and trade transit. That means India giving Bhutan access to world markets for its own goods to pass through. Similarly, for India-Nepal, there is India is exporting energy to Nepal, and there are many, many interesting developments now on India investing in Nepalese hydropower, and hopefully soon there will be flows of energy from Nepal to India. And now, in terms of connectivity, Nepal can use not only Kolkata Haldia port, but also Vishakhapatnam, the Vizag port, for accessing the world market. So these are just some of the developments on bilateral connectivity in the eastern part of South Asia. What is very interesting here is I want to connect the dots further and say these are actually developing into trilateral connections. For example, on energy, there's a possibility of Nepal, India, and Bangladesh, and Bhutan, India, Bangladesh. You know, there are these, you know, from wheeling energy via India from, say, Bangladesh, getting access hydropower from Nepal through India, and similarly Bhutan exporting to Bangladesh via India. So this becomes very promising. It's very good for regional cooperation. It's very good for trust overall, for the smaller countries to feel more confident in themselves and for dealing with India. So similarly on trade, we have the same two trilaterals that I mentioned. And there is a promise that Nepal can export now to Bangladesh within a simple framework of road access via India. And similarly, Bhutan being able to export to Bangladesh via India. This was supposed to be part of the BBIN Motor Vehicles Agreement, but that has not made as much progress as we had hoped. But I really hope that these trilateral possibilities, developments in trade and energy, actually hold out a lot more dynamic possibilities on the eastern side. Now, I don't want to neglect the western side because it's very much a part of South Asia. And in fact, the India-Pakistan relationship, actually, we know it holds back the dynamism of South Asia as a whole. But so what's happening on the Western front is there is, as you know, an APTTA, the Afghanistan-Pakistan Trade and Transit Agreement. And it exists since 2010. And there are proposals to revise it to reflect concerns by both sides. Here, of course, I cannot resist my optimistic side and think of grand possibilities here based on reciprocity. And let's start small. You know, for example, small by some standards, others might say it is big. India could India export to Afghanistan via the Wagah border using the land route? Currently, that's not allowed. Similarly, on a reciprocal basis, Pakistan could export to, say, Nepal via a specific land route in India. And to begin with, we could just use containers to allay suspicion, you know, specific containers going on host country trucks rather than the exporting country trucks. The logic of this can go much further, but I will not get into that because we need to have this kind of a starting point. But I do want to say that, you know, if there is this kind of connectivity, the possibilities are immense on the connecting Central Asia and South Asia. So the bottom line is here is that such initiatives can change the dynamics of the region, you know, for trade in, you know, land trade, rail trade, waterways trade that you mentioned. This is also a lot is happening there on protocols, and of course, in energy trade, air connectivity, and so on. So this, there are dynamic possibilities that are being unleashed, and I think positive, you know, good things feed on themselves. So hopefully there is a positive dynamic to be.
I completely agree with you, Sanjay, on that. In fact, maybe the COVID, in some respects, the exigencies that it presents to the governments of the region could be an opportunity that might galvanize the greater part of the region into collective action on improving connectivity. So let's hope it will happen that way. Now, I wanted to come to a very important point that you mentioned earlier in the course of our discussion, the developments around supply chains. And what we are getting to see is that the aftermath of COVID-19 has unleashed very specific changes, somewhat traumatic, somewhat turbulent changes in the regional order, which are to a very large extent driven by geopolitics. And there is an emphasis of supply chains getting organized around the prevailing tone and tenor of geopolitics that is shaping in the region, leading to reshoring of production, deliberate strategies being crafted for reshoring of production. And I specifically refer to the Resilient Supply Chain Initiative, which has been proposed by India, Japan, and Australia. And it is an initiative that is looking to expand by drawing in more countries from Southeast Asia and also probably from South Asia. Now, in this regard, Sanjay, I had a couple of questions which I could just merge together. One is that, do you think that this is a good development for South Asia? When I say good, I mean it more from a normative sense, in the sense of it being an economically beneficial initiative. And secondly, if so, how can South Asia respond to this development?
Yeah, no, those are important, both economic and, as you said, geopolitical questions. So one is, first thing is this, you know, obviously China is the issue here. And, you know, I think it's a long-term strategic, the RSCI, I think it has to be a long-term strategic play. China, as we all know, China's production ecosystem is incredible. It's comprehensive, it's resilient, it's also getting increasingly innovative. And it can, I'm told it can produce a prototype at lightning speed. So, you know, people, so whenever new products is being introduced, they turn to China because you can get a prototype in 7 days as opposed to months in other countries, even in advanced countries. So even if countries want to, this realignment, such as you mentioned in the RSCI, it's obviously not a near-term play, it's a long-term play. And other countries will need to join in. The more countries join in, the more workable, the more practical, the more possible it becomes. And I've seen your own piece on this in the Financial Express, which, you know, I like the issues that you laid out. But yes, so the bottom line is that it's a good thing for South Asia. And South Asia is positioned well from a geostrategic viewpoint to take advantage of this. But that's only from, in a sense, from a vision point of view. What about, as you said, the second part of your question, what will South Asia need to do in order to take advantage of these ongoing changes, realignments? So I think South Asia has a lot of hard work to do here. It needs to consciously present itself as an alternative, and not both in the form of intent, but also in the form of action. And mostly, it means getting its own house in order. You know, it's all about what South Asia does within South Asia. And I'll give a few points here. One is that South Asia needs to just embrace regional trade and global trade and shed its diffidence. You know, we know this. All countries, including India, are shy of trading. And an example, we unfortunately in South Asia, we're still dealing with first generation issues in trade. The world has moved past those. but we still have the highest tariffs in the world, which are non-transparent. They are rising now, unfortunately, in so many countries in the region. The countries of the region have invented almost, I would say, this curious phenomenon of paratariffs, which are widely used in Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And they're not a part of free trade agreements. So SAFTA doesn't work because they're not on the table when we have the South Asia discussion, South Asia free trade agreements. So we need to move on tariffs because that's the first thing that you need to have low uniform tariffs in order to have any sort of supply chain initiatives working. And then so work on SAFTA and then try to generalize this tariff reductions that would come about as a part of a more useful SAFTA, more workable SAFTA, and generalize them to other trading partners. So tariffs and paratariffs is the first thing that South Asia needs to, and gradually, I'm not saying you can't do this overnight because there are obviously jobs at stake in the countries based on high tariff walls, but you know, so gradually and with pre-announcement, and you know, we've all trade economists write about these things. So this is not impossible. It can be done, has been done. As you mentioned, these costs of trading are very high, and you know, I talked about that. But there is a broader general point on this costs of trading being very high is that procedures. Inefficient procedures, inadequate infrastructure. Now, the pandemic actually has enabled some good things here, enabled some innovations in trade facilitation in terms of digitizing processes, accepting electronic rules of origin certificates, electronic bills of lading and so on. So these are things which are very far-reaching for the region. And we should actually cast these in stone, if possible, and move on from there so that we don't go back to the old bad habits after once COVID is over. So that's part of the trade facilitation initiative. And then for a region where all countries except India are desperately seeking trade and product diversification, it is strange to find the reluctance to accept foreign investment, which is manifested not so much in the law, the legal basis, but in the practice of those foreign investment. So, you know, I've seen it firsthand in all the countries I've worked in the region. I've worked firsthand in so many countries, and I've seen this on the ground. And a sort of parallel aspect to that is that intra-regional foreign investment is very low. India is a massive investor, $13-14 billion overseas. Indian multinational enterprises invest every year, but a very tiny fraction of that goes to India. Now, given the very intimate link between trade and investment, much of this investment from India and other countries within the region needs to go to each other, you know, and that will also facilitate regional supply chains, regional value chains. We do have a forthcoming report coming out on this where we talk about, but that was my sort of unfinished work at the World Bank, and I am finishing it up with my colleague Ravi Yatawana on this. And finally, there are many new possibilities emerging also in e-commerce space, again, where the region can use to sort of grow more aligned with itself. So I think to take advantage of changes, realignments in the world trading system, not the system, but realignments in world trade, the partners in world trade, I think South Asia does need to do some of these things that I outlined in order to take actually advantage of what's happening out there.
Wonderful, Sanjay. In fact, we will look forward the report that you mentioned to get a greater understanding of the issues that we have discussed today, particularly on the supply chains. Now, it's been fascinating talking to you, but I'm aware of the fact that we are coming to the end of our conversation. We will soon wrap it up. So I wanted to end with your quick reactions on two specific issues. The first of these is that while we were on the supply chains and we have discussed those at length, are there specific industries from a South Asian perspective that you'd allude to, which I think are industries where South Asia can contribute very effectively to the realignments that are taking place in supply chains, and those might be economically very meaningful for the region. Would you like to give a couple of examples in this regard?
Sure. I think this is a very nice follow-up question. And I think if South Asia can work in a focused manner on one or two regional value chains and show that these can work, it would give a practical example to some of the issues that I raised just earlier. So for example, in pharmaceuticals, right? That's an area where I think it's a world leading sector now and will be, I think, in the foreseeable future in the long term, where there is capacity in India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan at the least. And we can work together in South Asia on the whole ecosystem of pharmaceuticals, right from innovation, which India is now gradually getting into. It's in all other parts, but from innovation right down to the very end, to the trials. I think this is an area where the region can come together and work as one, where the sum will be greater than the parts. Similarly related is medical equipment, again, including surgical instruments, where again, India and Pakistan have a lot of capabilities. They can come together and work. And the third area, which I will end with on this question, is on services more broadly. Again, a topical one is medical services, where they can, you know, they can be really a complete package for the world, where starting with remote diagnosis, on-site diagnosis, doctors, nurses, rehab services, yoga, Ayurveda, you know, drugs, and joining together to develop language-based offerings in all of these spaces, in Tamil, in Bengali, in Urdu, in Hindi, you know, all of these. So I think, and including distance medicine and distance learning, if one wants to expand examples in services. And these are very important industries in the context of digitization and in terms of, you know, health. So I think these are strategic and important industries, and South Asia is very well placed.
Sanjay, thank you. The last point in this conversation that I would want to have your quick views on is that when we look at calamitous developments across the world, and particularly the one like the COVID-19 that we are witnessing, we always observe that women bear a disproportionately larger hit on their economic prospects and their social well-being, as well as the ability to participate in the workforce and sustain from there. And the COVID-19 has not been any exception. And in this regard, obviously the sufferings of women have been particularly visible in the South Asian region as well. Would you like to share any final thoughts with us, given the experience that you have had in looking at trade in South Asia, that how might women be able to come out of the struggles that they're experiencing right now, and might trade be in a position to offer them better opportunities in turning around?
Yeah. So I'm so glad you asked this question, Amitendu. And this is an area which I'm getting increasingly interested in, this intersection of women's issues and you know, South Asian issues, because I think the two are very important. The intersection is very important. Now, as you said, COVID has, we know it has disproportionately affected women very hard, and you know, because of reduced demand in contact intensive sectors and in discretionary spending sectors like garments, where South Asia is very big. You know, 80% of the Bangladeshi garments industry is women workers serve that sector, and so it is in the rest of the region. So exports in, apart from India, the rest of the region is so dependent on this, on the garment and textile industry, where women predominate. Now, a recent World Bank report on women and trade, World Bank WTO report, showed that actually in exporting sectors, women fare better. They have more women are employed in exporting sectors, they have better wages, and the sectors are, the firms are less likely to be informed. So it's important, therefore, in a region where even before COVID, female labor force participation was already so low, we know that, especially in India and Pakistan, but also in most other countries except Bhutan and Nepal. It is imperative for to ensure that women do not drop out permanently from this workforce, and the region loses such a vital resource to itself, including in the exporting sectors. So this should be a starting point, ensuring that they don't drop out from their workforce permanently. And for this, government and the private sectors both need to play a role in doing that. So this is a vital untapped resource for the region. When we talk of skills shortages, well, you know, there are so many women who are keeping out of the first workforce, both semi-skilled and highly skilled. So I think South Asia has a lot more to do there. And, you know, we can talk about that some other day. But I'm great that you asked this question as the last one, because I think it's important to end on that note that women have been badly, badly affected, and that this we all need to be mindful of that as we plan for the recovery.
Thank you so much, Sanjay. It's been phenomenal. It's been such a great pleasure in exchanging so many topics of contemporary relevance and vital public policy relevance with you in the sphere of international trade and regional trade, and of course, the South Asian region. It's been a pleasure learning from you. It's been a pleasure listening to the great wisdom that you have shared with us. And thank you so much for the valuable time that you took in being with us here today. It's been a greatly beneficial experience for all of us. Friends, for all of you who took part in listening to this podcast, that was Professor Sanjay Kathuria, and in a conversation with the Institute of South Asian Studies podcast region, the subjects that we covered were regional trade outlook for South Asia. Please follow us on our website as well as in the social media, and we would strive to bring you more and more interesting episodes of such engaging conversations with experts from all around the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.